This is David Alan Miller, and I'm talking with the great pianist Andre Watts. And I'm delighted and honored to be able to talk to you, Andre. It's been a long time since you were last in Albany. I'm ashamed to say it's been, I think, 17 or 18 years. But we are so happy that you'll be coming back to be with us to play the Brahms Second Piano Concerto. And tell me how you've been these last years. Is everything well with you?
Everything is fine with me, thank you, and I'm looking forward to coming back to Albany and doing the Brahms together.
Right, we're so happy to have you.
It has been a long time, but it'll be fun to reconnect.
I remember that monumental program you played when you were last with us. It was a benefit that you graciously did completely free for Classical Action, classical musicians against AIDS or to solve the problems of AIDS. And I seem to remember you did both Liszt concertos and the Rachmaninoff second on that program. Is that right?
Oh my gosh! Really?
I think that's what you did.
Did I really?
Yes, you did. You were
how terrifying!
Very irresponsible.
Very. I must say. And when I've been asked about it, I said yes. I remember that we played Second Rachmaninoff. I completely blocked out the two lists. Really?
Yeah,
is that true?
It is absolutely true. It was all your program, and it was an amazing feat because those two lists are signature pieces of yours, as is the Rachmaninoff. So it was really a thrill. Yeah, but I remember there was a terrible thing that happened that I was quite chagrined about ever after, because I heard that when you got back to your car after our post-concert reception and all, that your car was gone. Is that true?
I think it was towed. Yes.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Thankfully, I'm not sure, but I think it was a rental, so maybe it was not so serious.
Oh, I think it was. The story I heard was that you had to pay some significant amount of money to get your car out of hock.
That part I remember.
Yeah. So not only did you donate your services, but you then were charged for coming to play with us. So I hope this will. We hope to spoil you greatly when you're here.
Well, I'll be careful where I park.
Don't even park. Don't even bring the car. Take the train, something like that. So I wanted to ask a little bit because I thought our listeners might be very interested. I mean, I'm sure everybody or most of our listeners know the story of your auspicious debut when you were still in knickers, when you were 16 years old. I mean, I know you had played with the Philadelphia Orchestra a couple times before that, but you,
right,
you debuted with the New York Philharmonic and Bernstein on a children's concert when you were 16. Is that right?
One of the young people's concerts that Bernstein had. I auditioned for that, and I played in the fall of 62, and those were broadcast. And then in January of 63, Glenn Gould canceled. And I remember on a Tuesday morning I got a call from Carlos Moseley, who was the general manager.
Oh, sure, I remember.
Philharmonic, and said, "Well, would you like to come back and play the Liszt again with us on Thursday night and Friday afternoon?" And so I did that, and you know, I've talked about it, that people that I say, you know, chance plays such an important part in careers, and people think, "Oh, isn't that nice? He's so humble." It's not humility at all. There was a newspaper strike in New York at the time. And so all of the big magazines, Time, Life, you know, Ebony, things like that, sent people to cover the concert. And so it was a successful concert, and so they all did articles.
Oh, I see, which they wouldn't have done if the newspapers were covering it?
Precisely, precisely. And so it was a big hoopla, and that was really sort of overnight, I mean, so to speak, the beginning of my career.
And you were still a high school student in Philadelphia at that time, right? You were still...
That's right. I was living in Philadelphia and still in school.
What grade would you have been in? Was that?
I was in my sophomore year of high school. I then went and finished the last 2 years in 1 year, the following year. And then took a year off and then went to study with Leon Fleischer and went to Peabody.
At Peabody, right. So did that completely mess up your life or change your life or make it wonderful? Or was it just kind of one of those happenstance
things?
Well,
it was wonderful, and it completely messed it up, so to speak. But it was, I can't really think of any particular negatives, I have to say.
It dashed all your hopes of going into a career in accounting. That's what happened, yeah?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I got to, you know, play a couple of concerts in the first year with really, you know, great conductors, and it was pretty wonderful.
And I've always been fascinated by your repertoire, which is really the big monumental masterpieces of the 19th century. I mean, I know that you certainly play other music and you play that wonderful McDowell Concerto and various other things, but can you tell us a little bit, because I've always been interested in this in terms of how, particularly pianists, because there's such a vast range of repertoire available to pianists that isn't available to trombonists or perhaps oboists, or how do you, or how does a pianist sort of decide or gravitate toward a specific part of the repertoire?
I don't know. I think the gravitational pull is probably not particularly logical. It's probably very subjective. You know, you play what you love. You know, internally. But then also, you know, it varies. Those pianists who I have colleagues and, you know, deceased and living, who learn voluminously, you learn very quickly and absorb massive amounts of music. If you look at somebody like Claudio Arrau, played all of the music of Chopin, all of the music of Bach, all Brahms, all Schumann, all the Beethoven sonatas, that's when you have that kind of ability, ability and training and early in kind of induction, then you can cover a much wider range of repertoire, obviously. For those of us who learn a little more slowly, you have to pick and choose sort of carefully. I mean, and as you get older, also, you sort of recognize, well, there are hundreds and hundreds of pieces I would ideally like to learn, but there's not enough time left. And so you have to pick and choose and decide, well, what will I enjoy, what will be compelling to actually practice for performance. And then the other stuff you just sort of read through whenever you have some leisure.
And yet at the same time, would you say that there are, just sort of in essence, based on with whom you studied and how your technique was evolved or developed, that there certainly seem to me to be pianists who gravitate more to virtuosic repertoire and then other pianists who gravitate more to Bach and Mozart? I mean, is that more to do with how one is trained? Or
I think a little bit. I mean, again, personal predilection obviously plays a big role. You're probably lucky if you studied with someone whose own interests were very wide-ranging and encouraged you to look at a wide range of literature. I mean, I had wonderful teachers, and then when I was around 19, I went to study with Leon Fleischer, whose range of repertoire is extremely wide. And so he would occasionally suggest, well, you know, you maybe a little more impressionistic music here. Why don't you learn this piece or that, or what about, you know, the Copland Sonata, or, you know, things of that nature. So that then pushes, I mean, you know, students and young people and maybe even not so young people, all of us, need to have at least suggestions made that, oh, have you considered, have you looked at such and so? Have you thought about this or that? And then your curiosity is piqued, and it can help you broaden your repertoire, yeah.
And I always feel like that's a really wonderful aspect of what makes a good teacher, the diagnostic aspect of it, of, you know, it would be helpful for you to work on this piece at this point in your evolution or development, that can be really a critical aspect of helping a student, as you say.
Yeah, I think that it's necessary. You know, you watch a student for a year or two and go in certain directions, and then you realize that there's maybe some repertoire that they are not playing, which would add to their sound arsenal. Never mind technical, physical, you know, that too. But just would open make a wider horizon for them about sound possibilities.
Right.
I mean, someone who plays a lot of, let's say, Debussy and Chopin and even maybe some Spanish music exclusively, then you have to push them, I think, in, you know, they don't have to perform it, but they really, really have to study and learn more Mozart, more Beethoven, Scarlatti, Bach, and so forth. And the opposite also.
People who play only the
classics, students should probably be pushed then to play impressionistic music, also contemporary.
So in your role as a teacher, because I know you're now and have been for just about, is it about 10 years you've been at Indiana?
About 10 years now at IU. Yeah, yeah.
You're a distinguished, or I don't know what your exact title is, but you're a distinguished professor.
I'm just a professor.
Oh, you're just a professor. Well, I think you're distinguished, whether they think you are
Thank
or not,
you.
At this great Jacobs School of Music, one of the most celebrated music schools in the country and the world, and an incredible, gigantic, I think it's the largest major music school in the country. With your students, so you really are not merely working on the pieces that you yourself perform publicly, but you're actually having your students play a lot of repertoire that isn't your normal repertoire. Is that right?
Or? Well, yes. I mean, people, you know, somebody comes and says, well, you know, I think I'd like to play the Goodbye Dulina Chaconne. Well, uh-huh. That's a piece I've never learned. So
right.
Then, you know, that's why I guess you teach. You have more experience. So you look at a score like that and you absorb some of it immediately and quickly, and especially you don't have to do the actual physical working, so you can see things that maybe have escaped them or they haven't thought of yet, haven't gotten to yet, and you can shorten that process. And also, you know, I, every once in a while I have students who come and then they're very anxious to play a lot of Liszt because, you know, I'm...
Well, you're a Liszt guy.
Yeah, yeah, right. Uh-huh. Well, that's not really true, but, you know, and that's uh-huh. fine. I'm happy to do that, but then I immediately that makes a bell go off, and then I double-check their repertoire and see which aspects of the literature are weak in the sense of very small amount. And if it's a meaningful, you know, important composer, if there's very little Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, Bach, something like that, then I push in that direction, sure.
Tell me this thing about Liszt, because you've just sort of disavowed your being a Liszt guy, and yet I remember reading somewhere that your mother, when you were a little kid, your mother sort of telling you the inspirational story of Liszt's own life and adventures to sort of inspire you. Is that apocryphal, or is that really what happened?
Oh, well, no, that's true. That's uh-huh. true, and of course...
Because your mother, I should mention, your mother was Hungarian, is that right? Or she's
right, right, yeah. right. The Liszt, although, she never told me, you know, big stories about Bartók.
Right.
because it wasn't, you know, as romantic and all that to uh-huh. capture the imagination. And she really harped on how much he practiced. And so that uh-huh. was a way of getting me to practice. And, of course, you know, I mean, the debut that I had with Bernstein and the Gould substitution was with the first Liszt concerto.
Right.
So that stuck with me. But, you know, after the first, I think after the first 2 years, so after I was like 18 or 19, I don't think I played the Liszt concerto for 10 years.
Uh-huh.
I made a point of not playing it.
Right, of moving around the repertoire. Yeah.
Yeah, right. You know, then at some point, until I was about 23 or 25, the concerto I played most in my life was Beethoven 4.
Uh-huh.
And since then, probably, I would say it's Brahms 2nd and maybe Rachmaninoff 2nd are... And of course, still Beethoven 4 are probably the concertos I've played most
in my life. That's a perfect segue into this Brahms 2nd piano concerto, which you'll be playing with us. Can you tell us a little bit about it or what makes it special or its unique place in the repertoire?
Well, you know, it's one of the pinnacles in concerto literature for pianists. I mean, it's a massive piece. It contains just about everything there is. You know, it has chamber music, in essence, in the slow movement. It's a massive virtuoso work, has lightness and charm, has power and threat, and all, you know, it runs the gamut. It is like a kind of mini universe of music. It's a piece that it's one of the first things I played for Leon Fleischer. And I remember I brought this, I wanted to learn this piece, and I brought it to him, and I think I knew his recordings, and so he looked at me, I was just 19, I think, and mm-hmm. he said, well, you've got a tiger by the tail here, just keep going, and, you know, it'll develop.
Right.
And I remember that I played it, actually one of my first performances when I was 19 was in San Francisco with Joseph Cripps, and it was substituting for my teacher, Leon Fleischer.
Uh-huh.
And that was a really enormous, enormous deal.
Uh-huh.
And I was very fortunate in my early years of playing this piece. I played it with really great conductors, and by chance they were all very, very nice to me. They seemed to like me, and they were kind, and so they taught me a lot.
Mm.
They, you know, it was the process of rehearsing and playing also was almost in a way like having lessons.
Right.
So that was so the piece. It, the terrible thing is, of course, it doesn't get that much easier
with the
passage of years.
And it is one of the more terrifying, technically terrifying concertos in the repertoire, isn't it? I mean, it's
technically it's a massive piece and has lots of some things that appear perfectly ordinary are actually very sort of, as we say, knuckle breaking and complicated. And there is some advantage to playing these pieces when you're very young, because then you get to just, as you grow with them.
Right. But I would think there's some great advantage to playing them when you're a little older, leaving aside the technical aspects, in that particularly this piece and pieces like this are such mature works. And, you know, this is the adult Brahms writing this. And I suppose your life experience would inform your performance differently now from the way it would have 30 or 40 years ago.
Yes, I certainly hope so, and I think that it's almost automatically happens, you know, as you hopefully develop as a human being, so does your view of what he wrote. And as you say, this is at the opposite sort of spectrum for Brahms. You know, there are only two piano concertos, and first is Opus 15, and that's a young man's, you know, heaven-storming but divinely beautiful slow movement piece. Whereas this has this second concerto of Brahms has a lot of the sort of vista of looking back on a complex life.
Yes, it does. I have one more question I wanted to ask you, sort of an odd offbeat early life personal question. It happens that one of our beloved board members is one of the main sponsors of this concert that you're presenting with us, Rabbi Scott Spien, who's the rabbi at a big Reform synagogue here at Temple Beth Emeth. And he was very excited to help underwrite this concert because he said his mother studied with your teacher. And I said, well, which teacher? And I didn't even know that his mother was a pianist. And it turns out with Mr. Petrillo. Is that one of your teachers?
Clement Petrillo,
right.
Oh my gosh.
Because he grew up in Philadelphia, or outside of Philadelphia, I think in Cherry Hill. And then I said, well, was your mother a professional pianist? Oh no, when she was an adult, she took piano lessons with Mr. Petrillo, probably roughly the time that you were taking lessons with Mr. Petrillo as a kid. But he was very excited to have that connection. So just, can you tell me just a little bit about Mr. Petrillo?
Well, I studied with Clement, we called him Clem Petrillo, for... I would say maybe from the time I was about 17 to 19. And I went to his home very often in New Jersey and studied with him. You know, he lived with Toscanini for a couple of years in Riverdale.
Really?
And in that household with Toscanini and Horowitz. And so he would tell me all these stories.
Wow.
But he was a very extraordinarily wonderful musician. Very subtle with pedaling. I mean, he really sort of got on me about pedaling. Now, you know, I'd already played, you know, a couple of...
Serious dates?
You know, concerts with the New York Philharmonic and done tours and whatnot. But he pedaling and approach to the keyboard, it was a fabulous... It was a little bit brief, I mean, in the sense of a year and a half, 2 years, but a very, very special kind of studying and an immersion in music in the broader sense somehow. You know, the whole Toscanini connection and had made me listen to more orchestral music and performances and relate or that to the piano playing. And it certainly wasn't the intent, but it was a phenomenal preparation to actually be able to learn from Leon Fleischer.
Uh-huh.
I learned a great deal in the year and a half, 2 years before I went to Leon, and therefore it was easier for me to absorb all of the, you know, magical stuff that Leon taught and does still teach.
You were made ready for him, right?
Yes, in so many words. Yes.
How wonderful. Well, listen, Andre, we're so happy that you're going to be with us, and we're so looking forward to it. And thanks very much for taking the time to chat with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, David, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Great. Thanks a lot.
That was Albany Symphony Orchestra Maestro David Alan Miller speaking with pianist Andre Watts, who will join the symphony in concert on January 11th at the Palace Theater in Albany, New York. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.